I apologize for being late. I guess session moves on, that'll probably be more and more the case. We're going to start with a work session on Senate Bill 444.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Senate Bill 444 is the bill relating to Department of Corrections and making rules for where to place sex offenders upon release. It was introduced by Senator Metzger, and we heard testimony on it last, I think it was on February 27th. If you look at the -2 amendments that have been prepared for you, those are ready to be adopted if you would like to have them adopted. And I also have the, Enola made a hand engrossed the bill to see what those amendments would do section by section. In section one, the definition has changed, as you'll see on page one, line five. The applicability of the rules for where to place sex offenders is limited on line 10, so that it only applies to sexually violent, dangerous offenders and predatory sex offenders. The other amendments are that this does not apply to transitional housing, and that was one of the issues that Diane Ray from the Board of Parole raised, that it would be very difficult for them to apply this when they have a person in a halfway house basically for 45 days. So it will only apply to the permanent residents. I did talk to Paul Siebert down in fiscal. This has an indeterminate fiscal impact, and he also mentioned that the -2 amendments, which I took down to him, he believed those would lessen the impact for this bill, but he doesn't have a number.
All right, we are in work session.
Mr. Chair, I'm with the -2 amendments to the Senate Bill
444. All right, Senator Courtney moves adoption of the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 444. Is there discussion?
Let me just make sure of one thing, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
I learned in High Council, just want to be sure the reference to predatory sex offender or dangerous sex offenders.
Let me give you the definition for those. Predatory sex offender is an assessment by the Department of Corrections and the Parole Board. Let me just quote the statute. In determining whether a person is a predatory sex offender, an agency shall use a sex offender risk assessment scale approved by the Department of Corrections. So that is an assessment that happens and is done by a group at the Board of Parole. Sexually violent dangerous offender is a determination at the time of sentencing. Quote, sexually violent dangerous offender means a person who has psychopathic personality features, sexually deviant arousal patterns or interests, and a history of sexual assault, and who the court finds presence a substantial probability of committing a crime listed in subsection 3 of this section, which would be rape, forcible compulsion, and sexual abuse.
Counsel, let me ask you a question. I want to be very sure of something because I have a history of this bill. It's my bill, and they took it off and tried to knock it out, and we made it. We saved it. We were able to survive a constitutional challenge because the way we drew it up. So I want to be sure we're not giving them an opportunity to knock it out. You mentioned the category of predatory sex offender. I don't have any problem with that. But you've got this other category now, violently, this other group. So they're now part of the sex offender notification law, is that right? Are they presently part of it, or are you adding them into it?
They are already presently.
Excuse me, could you come forward, please, Mr. Chair? Because I want to be sure we're being very careful here.
Darcy Baker, Clackamas County Community Corrections, and Chairman and members of the committee, they are part of what would be considered the predatory offenders at this time and would be considered for notification.
Thank you. Just, Mr. Chair, not to take your time, and believe me, so many of these kinds of laws nationwide have been thrown out. Ours survived it, so I want to be real careful that we weren't getting ourselves into a situation where we lose something, which I think has been a very good piece of legislation. That's self-serving to say that. But. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
What's new?
Just kidding.
Okay. Any other discussion? Any objections to the adoption of the -2 amendment? If not,
Chair, I move Senate Bill 444 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Courtney moves the adoption of the Senate Bill 444 as amended by the committee to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Senator Byron.
Question of counsel, I guess. The changing of the terminology where children are likely to be present to where children are the primary occupants or users, what in a practical effect does that mean?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senator Byer, that is a change that was worked with local, the local community people. I don't know if Senator Metzger wants to answer that or if he'd like me to.
Well, actually, I think it would be good maybe if Mr. Taylor and Darcy were back, because that was part of the work group in defining how that would be. And I think they would probably be our best experts on that.
Scott Taylor, for the record, Scott Taylor, Oregon Department of Corrections.
Still Darcy Baker.
Let Darcy fill in the majority of it, but the work around this was when, in identifying that population, when we looked at all the different places where children might gather, what we wanted to do was really focus on where they will be more congregated and where they normally will appear. So we were trying to, for the functionality of trying to find that space and measure and know where to go and talk, we wanted to be clearer about where our primary concerns were with our current way of managing.
Where could you expect to find children was our thought behind that language change. You could expect to find them at elementary, secondary schools, that sort of thing. If we took away where children, let me go back to the original language here, are likely to be present, because that was so vague to us, and this way, by going where they're the primary occupants, it really brought it down and made it more manageable.
Go ahead, Senator Byer.
Okay, and I understand the primary occupants part, but you've got primary occupants or users. I guess by adding those last two words, is that tightening the definition from likely to be present, or is that loosening the definition of likely to be present?
So it tightens it for me in terms of my way of thinking. I'm thinking also like boys and girls clubs would be primary occupants or users of that sort of thing. Say Bullwinkles in Wilsonville, which is an amusement.
But you're really talking about a location where it's more than incidental use.
Absolutely.
Or occupation by a child, so that you're really talking about something, like you say, like a boys and girls club or a licensed daycare center, or where there's a house full of children that you know live there, as opposed to the grandchildren visit from time to time, so to speak.
Correct.
Or children walk by the front of my house every third day or every other day. And allowing those kind of circumstances to come under the law. So I actually think the discussion's good for the record, because the intent is to narrow it to places where you could expect that they're the primary occupants, i.e. they live there, it's a residence, or they're the primary users. And that's the way I read it. The primary user, primary occupant.
Mr. Chair, that is our intent also.
Any other questions?
No, I think that's good clarification. You know, perhaps the word primary should have been in front of the word user then also, and maybe it is implied. But, I mean, I wasn't sure just by reading it is location of the children are the primary occupants or users. I was unsure if that was tightening or loosening from likely to be present. Likely to be present is the definition we use in school zones. I think that's pretty tight. I mean, that seems that, you know, if they're likely, I'm assuming that's where this language came from, was the school zone idea. And I was unclear if we were tightening or loosening it. So are the courts also going to be unclear if it's...
Any English majors in here? It seems to me if we put primary occupants and primary users, that's redundant. But I didn't major in English. It could go either way. Okay. Staff counsel was an English major, so she's saying it could go either way.
Mr. Chair, I'm not trying to hold the bill, I just want to get cleared, and I think it's clear now for the record, if it ever gets to the case that the court goes back and looks, it's quite clear the drafter's intent was to tighten the language, so.
And
there's not a second thought, so I think you're safe.
And so, and what I would do is, I'm assuming that Senator Metzger's going to carry this on the floor, that issue be addressed in the floor speech, so that be that, that's there for the record. Okay, any further discussion? Any objections? Very none. Senator Metzger, I assume you want to carry the bill?
Sure, I'd be happy to do it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. And next up on our list, Senator 220, public hearing. Senator Courtney.
My individuals are here from the OSAA, who we introduced the bill for, so I would like to have go to them right away. It involves a appeal procedure.
Okay. Is it Wes Ettinger and
yes.
Don Carter?
Right. Senator Maness, I'm Wes Ettinger from the Oregon School Activities Association, the executive director, and with me is my assistant, Tom Welter, and our attorney, Don Carter. We're here today to talk about Senate Bill 220, and basically it's a financial thing for us, and I think as we go through this and our attorney goes through it, you'll see that in a little later. But the legislature back in the middle 80s defined a appeals process for us, which included three steps, and the third step being a hearing with the State Department of Ed. And we think that's the place where it should end, like in most hearings officers' cases, and go from there to the appeals court. So I'd like our attorney, Don Carter, to follow up now and explain why and how we got here.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Don Carter, an attorney in Portland for the Oregon School Activities Association. The impetus for this bill is that for reasons that are not apparent, the 1993 legislature amended the statute that was adopted by the 1987 legislature and changed the appeal process for decisions of the Oregon School Activities Association. And just to give you a brief discussion, I will be brief. Lawyers say that and then they never are, but the Oregon School Activities Association is one of 15 organizations that is approved to administer interscholastic activities, and it has rules that govern those interscholastic activities for all high schools that are members across the state. And when a student is aggrieved by a decision of the Oregon School Activities Association, there are appeals processes within the organization that may be taken, actually two steps that may be taken within the organization, the second of which is a public panel that has five people on it, one lay person, a couple of superintendents, and a couple of principals from around the state that decide those cases. And then if the student or the student's parents are still unhappy with that decision, the next step in the appeals process is an administrative hearing before the state superintendent of public instruction under ORS 339-450. And when this statute was initially adopted, the appeals process then went from the superintendent of public instruction to the Court of Appeals. For some reason in 93, the legislature changed that and adopted an appeals process that inserted a step, and that was it went from the superintendent of public instruction to the Court of Appeal, circuit court, excuse me. And so that the case is tried again in the circuit court after it's already been heard before the state superintendent of public instruction. And only then does it go to the Court of Appeals. Many of these cases are time critical, and the state superintendent of public instruction appoints a hearings officer very rapidly. We try to get in there and get these cases heard very quickly so that the issues are resolved rapidly. What this does really is delay the process in that There is a hearing before the superintendent. The superintendent issues a decision, and the next step is that it goes back to court again, and the case is retried in the circuit court. And from the OSAA's position, this is a waste of judicial resources, and it is a waste of time, because the substantive appeal is still to the Oregon Court of Appeals. And if a student or the OSAA is ultimately unhappy with that decision, then it should be taken to the Oregon Court of Appeals for final resolution. Committee counsel, Ms. O'Dell has raised another issue with me, that there is an ambiguity in the statute whether this should be a contested case hearing or not. And it has historically been treated as a contested case hearing before the State Superintendent of Public Instruction. So it would not be a change in practice for the statute specifically to provide that the hearing before the State Superintendent of Public Instruction is a contested case. And so one of the things that might be suggested here is that subsection 3 of that statute, just prior to the amendment that the bill actually proposes, be amended to say on line 18, to hear the matter and enter final order under ORS 183.310 to 183.550, rather than saying pursuant to ORS 183.464 sub 1. I'd be happy to respond to questions.
Okay, Senator Burdick.
So with a contested case hearing, the record would not, they don't have any limitations on how they compile the record. For example, they have subpoena power, they put people under oath, they do everything basically that the circuit court could do.
That is correct. The hearings officer swears in the people, and they are subject to subpoena by the hearings officer, and they're under oath. Cross-examination is permitted.
Go ahead.
As this has been in practice, has the circuit court tended, is the circuit court process tended to get into other areas or to treat it substantively differently, or has it just been redundant?
The most recent case that we had, the circuit court heard the same information and rendered the same decision that the State Superintendent of Public Instruction did.
All right. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on the issue of the 183.464-1, to change that to whatever it was you said. So currently the statute is telling the superintendent to do it one way, and the superintendent's doing it another?
No, I don't think that that's so. I think that the administrative rule, and I didn't realize that this issue was there until I came to the hearing, so I didn't bring the administrative rule, but I believe that the State Board of Education's administrative rule on this issue calls for a contested case hearing, and that is how historically the cases have been handled.
Another question? Council's got a response.
I think, Senator Beyer, maybe I can clarify. The way the statute's currently written, it refers to a process under 183.464 sub 1, which is a contested case reference. So it has been handled, as I understand it, as a contested case hearing. It's just not the most clear way and leaves some ambiguity open to what the proper process is. So this would be a housekeeping measure to make it clear so that there wasn't some judicial interpretation at some future time that it wasn't clearly made a contested case process. The reason this came up was because typically the reference and the appeal to the circuit court is used for non-contested case procedures. And there was a recent case last year, the Norden case, which made it clear that those cases are a de novo review. It's a complete retrial of the case that was held by the hearing officer. Usually cases are reviewed on the record that's made at the time of the contested case, and that is so that the hearing officer who's making the decision has all of the information in front of them to make a well-reasoned decision, and that's sort of an integrity of the process issue. So the reference would just be a technical change to make it clear. I first clarify a statute that was probably not as clear as it should have been when it was drafted.
One more, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to maybe hear from Senator Courtney. I think he was here in both 87 and 93 on the other side of the building. Obviously, the legislature must have changed this, not just because they wanted to. I mean, there must have been a reason for them doing it. And I just would ask if Senator Courtney can remember the issue at the time. And
I wasn't here in 87, Senator Barr. Was this? I'm not going to say anything because I can think of why it might have been, but I'd rather hear. Does anybody, do any of the witnesses remember what was going on in 93? I was here in 93, but I don't remember why we did this or if this committee even did it. So there were a number of issues that have been swirling around the OSAA over the years. I don't remember.
Up in Senator Courtney, Chairman Menace, up until 87 or so, the OSAA, and I wasn't associated with it at the time, but we didn't have any appeals process. You know, the executive director made all the decisions and was down here quite frequently to testify on different issues, and the legislature at that time mandated that we had to come up with an appeals process that made some sense. And so now, as Don Carter said, that, you know, our appeals process that if I make the decision and they don't like my decision, the next step they can take it to our appeals board, which is made up of lay people and school people mix. And then the third step, if they support my denial, then they can go to the State Department of Ed. And that's a process that was set up because of the displeasure that the legislature had back in those days.
What happened in 93?
In 1993, Senator Courtney, the education statutes were revised, and I've done some legislative history looking at that revision to determine whether how this got in here. And insofar as I've been able to determine, the issue was not discussed in a committee meeting, in a work session, or anywhere. I have not found that. And so it isn't clear to me whether it was oversight, inadvertence, whether someone read it differently in 1993 than people did in 87.
Senator Barr, you started this. I'll go back to you.
Okay, I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Duncan probably has some history here, too, but I mean, I guess it's another factor of term limits or whatever, but I just, you know, a couple of days ago ended up getting beat up for a half hour, 45 minutes on the floor because it was going back and changing a deal that was cut in 91 by the legislature. And, you know, just trying to find out if there's some history here.
No, I was here in 1987, and my feeble mind is remembering a fairly spirited floor debate involving Representative Bruce Hugo, but I don't recall what the substance of it was, but it had something to do with some issues that he had with this particular organization, but I think it had more to do with some problems or something that he was trying to rectify as opposed to the substance of the process and so forth. But you were a superintendent of
public Mr. Chair, all of a sudden,
so
some things are gradually coming back. And I'd sort of forgotten, but I think I remember what triggered the whole thing. There was a very, very prominent lobbyist. Son was involved in something with the school district, and he raised a question, brought it to the attention of the Legislative Assembly, brought to my attention, Legislative Assembly, and the director at that time, and I don't think it was 87, it was not Peterson,
Don,
made the comment, "We are a private organization, and no blankety-blank legislature is going to tell me how to run it." Well, at that point,
bad things to say. I think that was in Bruce's speech.
At that point, things started to happen, and that's what triggered the whole thing.
Yeah, you said what I wanted to say earlier there, but thanks.
Okay. I do. Dave Barrows. And that's worse. That's
so David's not here to contest this.
He could tell us the history of that a little bit. But there were some places where you ruled because
Claire wants to find out.
I'm trying to remember if I ruled against OSA. Nike and OSA were involved in something, and I ruled, and I can't recall if it was I made the ruling for school districts or against OSA. I said students could not participate in a Nike-sponsored track because they did not allow, they had no provisions, no women's divisions in it. And it was a...
You kind of started all that.
Yeah, I did. And it was the Oregon, Washington, Idaho, it was during the Rose Festival period of time. That's right, that was the history of that. And I said no Oregon school could participate in that activity. That meant they couldn't have the coach on site, they couldn't use a pole vault, they couldn't do anything. That was all kind of going on at the same time, I recall that.
All right. But the issue before the committee, coming back to the bill.
Yeah. Well, to the bill.
Given that it is a contested case hearing, and it is some of the swear witnesses, and they take testimony,
right.
I'm assuming it's recorded.
Yep.
Yes.
It's recorded, so there's a record. Whether or not we want to maintain the existing statute, if there was an appeal, go to the circuit court and do that all over again, as opposed to going to the Court of Appeals. And I think over time we've been adjusting a number of different administrative agencies so that the appeals did go to the Court of Appeals as opposed to circuit court, particularly as we've gotten into, and you were an ALJ for a while, so we've gotten into that whole arena, contested case hearings, and have a more of an evidentiary environment, I think. So.
A contested case is a full evidentiary hearing. The rules of evidence don't strictly apply to those procedures under the APA, but they can be guidance to the hearings officer.
Okay. So, and then the language with respect to the final order pursuant to 1-8-3-4-6-4-7-1 is just kind of by implication as a contested case hearing. Is that correct?
Correct.
All right.
Correct.
So do we have an amendment to change that or clarify the language?
Yes, I think, well, we don't have an amendment today. We have to get one.
Okay. Anybody else wanting to testify on this? No. Now, if somebody does have an issue with OSAA, I'm sure we'll hear about it.
I'm sure.
Soon. So we'll get an amendment crafted and bring the item back.
Happy.
See who shows up.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Very much.
Appreciate it.
You're welcome, sir. So let's see. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 220 and Senate Bill 774. Public hearing.
Who's those camera people, everybody, Rick?
I don't know.
Are you taking pictures? Are you taking news on it?
I don't know. Yeah, you did. You told him to do it.
I got a whole yesterday.
He was sitting over there saying, shoot me, shoot me.
It was a still photographer. I don't know.
Well, I see. You only do TV. That's right. I'm sorry. God forbid. I
would never mess with you on paper. They were
I wish I kept my mouth shut.
All right. Senate Bill 774, Council, would you tell us why we're doing this?
Yes. This is a bill that was requested by Arnold Polk, an attorney from Beaverton. It clarifies that a personal representative of a decedent may bring an action for abuse. That includes both physical abuse and financial abuse under the statute. There is a current law that provides that personal injury claims survive death, but there is no statute addressing the financial abuse aspects. We have a letter, an exhibit, testimony from Mr. Polk that he's has been presented to you here.
All right, and I'm Bertram Koch.
I need to declare a conflict of interest since I'm 65 and older.
Because you were incapacitated?
What's that?
Playmaker conflict of interest.
Bertram?
Senator Menace, members of the panel, my name is Bertram Kopp. I'm a senior advocate working to stop elder abuse in Oregon. I like the idea of Senate Bill 774, but I feel it should be carried a little bit further as the handout being given to you goes on. Quite often, it is the very caregiver, it turns out to be the abuser. We've seen it all in the newspapers. There was a Higgins case in Forest Grove where they abandoned Mr. Hassenfuss at a dog race track in Idaho. Turns out to be his caregiver had also stolen $32,000 of his money. Then there was the DeGramelli case in which people used a power of attorney to leave an old woman who'd had a stroke in a nursing home in Reno, Nevada. They moved to Bend, Oregon, and used the money that they got from selling her house to buy themselves a house, a pickup truck, and a boat. She managed to convey her worries to a friend who lived here in Independence, who lodged a suit and took them to task to recover the money. So that's why we need to add more people to the list of people who can take the action. My suggestion is that line 19 be written as described here, allowing a relative or any person interested in the welfare of the individual be added to the list of those who can take action to recover the money.
Mr. Chairman, ask you a question.
Senator Duncan.
When you say a person interested in the welfare, I'm assuming that could be a close friend.
It could be a close friend.
Okay, that's
it. Could be a social worker working for SDSD. It could be anybody. Mm-hmm. But once they're established as being interested in that person's welfare and recovering funds for that person, that's good enough for me.
Well, I need a little direction on what is a personal representative for an estate.
Personal representative is a person representing the estate in a court.
So,
but this bill here spends most of its time worrying about after the person has died. And the personal representative is, of course, appointed by the court to settle the estate. But what do we do if the personal representative is also the one who stole the money? It's been done. So somebody else needs to have the power to take them to court. That's why I'm asking that this bill be added, these two categories of people be added to this bill.
All right. Sounds like a reasonable request.
I got a question.
I need more information, though, Senator Metzger.
I appreciate your thought on that. I was wondering, though, in the language that you're suggesting, whether that gets to what you're after. In other words, you're talking about somebody being a crook. I don't know that we have changed undefined the crooks out of this, because your language here says a person interested in the welfare of the individual. Well, anybody could call. I mean, a lot of crooks get on and say, I'm interested in the welfare of this person that just died, and give me the money. I mean,
anybody's welcome to do that, but he has to appear in court and prove that he is.
Well,
you see, that is, then he'll be faced with cross-examination. Exactly how do you know this person? Exactly how you are involved in it?
The language you have, sir, it doesn't say they have to prove it. It just says a person interested in the welfare of the individual. It doesn't say,
Well, at the start of the bill, it says the person may file suit.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just assuming that.
Yeah. I'm not arguing with your thought. I'm just thinking that, all the shysters out there, they're going to be interested in anybody who's dead who has money and claim I'm interested in their welfare.
True.
I just want to make sure that we don't exacerbate the problem.
I'm well open to suggestions of a better way of wording this. This is my first cut at it.
I understand what you're saying, so. I appreciate your thought on that.
If you want to put down a person who has been proven to be involved in the welfare, that's fine by me.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
So you're saying to us that some of the people who are personal representatives are also people who have somehow defrauded the estate.
I believe I make the point further down in my statement there that many people get greedy when they see an elderly person, a relative, obviously at the end of their life. They will seek to get control of them by guardianship, and only too often they succeed. They have a nice lawyer there who's got friendly relations with the judge, and he can't see any reason for turning it down, so they approve it. And you put a fox in charge of the hen house. This is one of the reasons there's a pattern of some certain judges doing this, and that's why we're pushing H.J.R. 23.
Which judges are you talking about?
Hmm?
Which judges are you talking about that have a panel?
I don't believe I should put them on the record now. One of mine in particular is now retired, but he would sit there when we were going through the guardianship works and say the most outrageous things. I wouldn't want him in charge of my dog, but he had put 300 or 400 people a year into guardianship. And his statement was, once I got him into guardianship, there's no way out but death. Would you like him in charge of you? Certain people do not...
Retired judge now? This person's a retired judge?
Hmm?
This person's a retired judge?
The retired judge was there at the meetings, and he made a lot of comments like that.
Who made the comment that you're...
The judge did.
The judge did.
Okay. And he also wanted to make guardianship of only people that had $12,000 a year or more income. He says, if they aren't making $1,000 a month, they're not worth worrying about.
All right. But you don't want to reveal who that is?
No, I'd rather not put it on the public record because I have found that some of my testimony has already found its way onto the Internet, and I'm reopening myself to a lawsuit unless I could substantiate that statement.
All right, which is exactly my point.
I can give it to you in person if you'd like it.
Okay. All right. Okay. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Let me see.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Can I ask a question for you, Co-Chair? Maybe, Mayor, could you explain personal representative again? I'm just curious of the language that they want to add, who the personal representative is, what that definition is.
The personal representative, usually, if the person has a will, they name a personal representative in their will, and that's the person that takes care of all of their final affairs. It also can be, in the case of intestate succession, it can also be the case of the person that the court would appoint to take care of the person's final affairs, but it is subject to appointment by the court and removal by the court if the court was to find that that person was not performing their duties effectively. Probably that would have to be brought to the court by court's attention by another beneficiary, and frequently the personal representative is a beneficiary under the will.
Okay, thank you, sir.
All right. I want to do a work session. 74, because it seems to me the issue is fairly simple. I mean, on the surface, and I appreciate Mr. your comments, but to me this just seems to try to clarify a very simple issue, and that is that if the person who's being represented...
You don't want this thing?
In a suit, no.
Yeah. 774 to the floor, you pass recommendation, Mr. Chair.
Senator Courtney moves Senate Bill 774 to the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Senator Duncan?
No.
Well, what I would like to do is if there's a need for this particular amendment, I would ask our counsel to do some research between now and the time it gets over to the House.
Okay.
And if there are some issues that the House committee can address, because we're kind of absent any substantive compelling testimony that requires change. I'd like to see something more than just conjecture and some judges' off-the-wall comments about this, that, or the other thing. Senator Burdick.
On those lines, too, I'm also sympathetic to the possible need for this amendment, but it seems to be broader than the scope of this bill. This bill is just making clear that the existing process exists for the estate after death, and the issues that were brought up, I think, expand beyond the scope of this bill.
Right. And have you worked with the Attorney General's office at all on elder abuse issues?
I have not been there, but I've been in plenty of other places and talked with people that have tried it. And,
okay. Well,
today is the first time my attention came to this particular bill. And I have not had a chance to touch bases with too many people on it.
All right. Well, we've got your information, I think. Do we have your phone number?
Yeah, I believe you have it on my application for HJR 23.
We'll get you hooked up then with the Attorney General's office, and maybe they can help you with a little bit more information about elder abuse issues and what they're doing, and maybe we can find something productive to do at some point. Any further discussion?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm going to vote for it, but on the basis of the fact that you're going to ask staff to help me work with House Staff, too, as this moves forward, if it does move forward.
Yeah, if there's a substantive issue that's raised, we can identify that. Sure.
I think I see an issue, but I think I observed one, and I would like to.
Okay, good.
This might have helped a little bit.
We'll make sure Ms. Odell comes to the chance with it.
Okay.
All right, further discussion. Any objection?
Who wants to carry this?
Senator Courtney will carry Senate Bill 774.
Of course. Just give them all something piled in the back.
Did you want to do it? Senate Bill 780. Public hearing. Team effort, baby. It's the old team effort, buddy. It's called team sports, Chris. It's very old. Team sports is track and field. I did my event. I'm going home. I don't care about you guys. It's raining out here. I'm going home. Masters the same way. Yeah. I mean, I grab my body parts. I'm out of here. I don't care about your weight division.
You got quite an audience. So.
Well, I like
chair. All at the same time.
Yeah. You might be able to solve that other problem with these gentlemen.
Yeah.
He's left for me.
Okay, who's going to start?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll begin if that's all right with you. My name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General, and I seem never to appear in this committee without a support team, and today is no exception. I'm joined at the table by Steve Schneider of the Senior Services Division, John Turner of the Marion County District Attorney's Office, and Rick Knapp of the Washington County District Attorney's Office. We're here in support of Senate Bill 780, which is a bill that arises out of the work of the Attorney General's Task Force on Elder Abuse. And that task force, in brief, has been in existence for a little over 5 years now, under two attorneys general, and this is one of the bills that group has proposed and supports. Briefly, this bill deals with the expansion of an exception to the hearsay rule. The hearsay rule is a rule that applies to exclude out-of-court statements that are offered into evidence to prove the truth of that statement. That's what hearsay is, and under the general rule, those kinds of statements are to be excluded from evidence in court proceedings. There are a large number of exceptions to that rule, and some of those exceptions are listed in Oregon Rule of Evidence 803, which, as you probably know already from your work on this committee, also takes the form of a statute, or S40.460, and that's the specific statute that's amended in the bill. Briefly, what this bill would do is expand one of the existing exceptions to include hearsay statements that are offered in cases involving allegations of abuse of an elderly person. Mr. Schneider is here to briefly describe, give you a brief picture of the nature of elder abuse as it exists in Oregon, at least as we know it exists in Oregon so far, and the other two gentlemen are here to give you an idea of how this bill would help in their specific practice of prosecuting cases of elder abuse.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Schneider. I'm an attorney with Senior and Disabled Services Division and here to testify in support of Senate Bill 780. SDSD has proactively worked with the Oregon law enforcement community, including prosecutors, to increase the awareness of elder abuse and neglect. SDSD is a member of the Attorney General Hardy Meyer's Task Force on Elder Abuse, and we have been instrumental in setting up elder abuse multidisciplinary teams in virtually every one of Oregon's 36 counties. With this increased attention to the victimization of the elderly and other vulnerable adults, more cases are working their way through the prosecutorial system. Unfortunately, a growing number of criminal cases involve elder or incapacitated persons who are either unable to testify or make poor witnesses due to their deteriorating medical or cognitive condition. There are cases in Oregon where an adult protective service worker and a law enforcement official have intervened on behalf of a victimized elder only to find that since the time of the victimization, the alleged victim has become demented, too frail to testify. These medical conditions and the resulting unavailability of the alleged victim pose difficult hurdles for a prosecutor who seeks to admit these statements as testimony. And as an example, there's a case currently in Central Oregon of a 90-year-old woman who allegedly was pushed and kicked by her daughter as she tried to get a checkbook to gain control of the finances. Law enforcement and Adult Protective Services did an initial investigation. Statements were taken, including statements by a medical official, and the prosecutor has decided that the alleged victim is too demented to take the stand and now has to seek prosecution under a misdemeanor assault four as opposed to a criminal mistreatment felony, which would be much more significant in terms of the sentencing guidelines. Senate Bill 780 provides an important tool to the criminal justice system by creating a hearsay exception for this type of out-of-court statement, and our agency, Senior and Disabled Services, supports this amended language. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Questions? Senator Metzger.
Could you give me just an example or two of you know, just lay examples of hearsay for elder abuse?
In this particular instance, Chairman Minnis, Senator Metzger, I think an instance would be a, say, a financial exploitation case where a senior who's being taken care of by a caregiver, which could be a paid caregiver or a family member, does some things or says some things that would be considered criminal in nature, possibly neglect, and law enforcement official and possibly an abuse prevention adult protective service person would go out and conduct an interview and an investigation. And then through the period of an intervention and interviewing and investigation, which could take several weeks or several months, the victim may come tracked or already have the early stages of Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia. And for the prosecutor, and I think I'll leave it up to these two gentlemen, the issue is, can you put this victim on the witness stand and have a credible witness who's going to be able to remember the nature of the facts and the statements? And currently, as the evidence code is written, this statement does not fall under the hearsay exception. So our goal is to get these people that have made these statements to proper authorities to allow their statements into court.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Britt?
I haven't looked up these ORSs that are cited in here, but does this put elders who are not capable of participating in a prosecution, does it put them in the same category as children, basically? Is that what this says?
Chairman Minnis, Senator Burdick, this attempts to put it into the same hearsay exception language as deals with children and also the developmentally delayed person who's under 18.
Are there any differences that are unique to this type of person in the bill? Are there any special provisions that don't apply to these other categories?
Chairman Minnis, Senator Burdick, I'll let the prosecutors answer that question, but I would say one thing, however, that when you're dealing with an elder victim or somebody who is developmentally delayed, you will not find the dementia, the Alzheimer's in, say, a child. And this is, I think, critical, is that many of our senior and elderly victims are victimized because of their vulnerable status. And we're seeing more and more cases coming through the system, and as that happens, we're going to find more and more alleged victims who are not able to testify. Thank you.
The prosecutors, if you could give us some examples in trial where you've had evidence that has been excluded.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Rick Knapp, and I'm a senior deputy district attorney with the Washington County District Attorney's Office. To answer your question specifically, an example might be of an elderly woman who's 90 years old, and she has made statements to the effect that her care provider has hit her, punched her in the face, and that's corroborated by the bruises on her arm. So the suspect is arrested. Now it's time for trial. Unfortunately, she doesn't remember, or even worse, she's deceased. We can't get those statements in now that she told the police officer or whoever she might have told that story to, because there's no way to get that evidence in at this point in time.
Now, how about if the police officer recorded those statements?
Even if those statements were recorded, if it's not domestic violence under 803.26, which is another exception to the hearsay rule, those statements would still not be admissible under the current law. What I'd like to go on and talk to you about, if I may, is in addition to my statement I provided to you, I would like to talk about the problem as it is in reality. And it is a problem. For instance, this morning before I came down here, I pulled from in my office three cases. And I'd like to talk to you about these cases just real briefly. This is State of Oregon versus Kenneth Nelson. It is set for trial March 27th. The victim in this case, the victim is the father of the suspect. After this incident occurred, he died. So now we have to go to trial on the 27th with no victim. In this case, the State of Oregon versus Juanita Mendez. This trial is set for April 6th. Subsequent to this incident occurring, the victim has died, and now we are faced to going to trial without the victim and no admissible evidence to prove our case, just like in State versus Kelson. This case, the State of Oregon versus Jorge Santiago. This case is set for trial on May 16th. As you can see, all these are set for trial the next month or two. This victim also passed away after the incident, is not available to testify. So it kind of gives you a sense for how serious the problem is. To answer Senator Burdick's question with regard to children, 803.18a(b) as it is presently constituted made a huge difference in the prosecution of child abuse cases. It is the difference between night and day, and we've had 803.18a(a)(b) now for some time. It has passed all the challenges in the court system, so there's no way that it violates the defendant's rights at all. And like I said, it's made a huge difference in the prosecution of child abuse cases. It will make the same difference in the prosecution of elder abuse cases that it made in child abuse cases. There is very little difference between the two. In fact, that's why I wrote Senate Bill 780 because I prosecuted child abuse cases for 15 years. And when I started doing elder abuse cases, I realized they were the same issues, the same problems in child abuse that we have in elder abuse, but we haven't yet expanded the 803.18a(b) yet to cover for elder abuse. Now, I don't know what's going to happen in these cases, and I can't tell you now, but I know that in the future, if we have 803.18a(a)(b) expanded by Senate Bill 780, it will make a great difference in the prosecution of these cases.
But, I'm sorry. I'm going to interrupt for just a second, because my mind is telling me that there is a medical exception for hearsay rule, medical diagnosis.
Yes.
Does that apply for elderly?
It would depend on your fact pattern. What we typically see in these elder abuse cases, though, and you have to remember, a majority of these cases are financial exploitation cases. So the victims are not going to see a doctor about and be treated for any kind of medical problem and being diagnosed. That medical exception only applies to that particular situation. What we're dealing with is more of a situation where an elderly person will say to a care provider, maybe, who comes into the house once a week, or maybe to a police officer, more likely probably a neighbor or a daughter, that so-and-so asked her for $10,000 because he was going to use it to help buy a gas station. Well, actually, he's got a gambling and alcohol problem. He took the money and went down to Las Vegas. And she's told that story to that, and it's been corroborated. The police did an investigation. They got the bank records, all this kind of stuff. But the problem is, before the trial goes, the case gets a trial, the victim either, for whatever reason, recants, is unavailable, or passes away. Now, those statements that she made that would help support our case and prove our case, we can't get in.
In a hearsay exception for child abuse, the child is considered to be unavailable or unable to testify. Obviously, if your victim died, they're clearly unable. But would this be a question at some point before the court as to whether or not the individual, if they were still living, was competent or capable to
to testify, and would there be like a competency hearing or something of that nature before the court?
Well, I think there's, Mr. Chairman, I think there's two facets to your question. One is, under 803.18a.a.b., if the witness is available to testify, like a child is available to testify, then the witness does testify. And because the witness is testifying, those statements under 803.18a.a.b. come in whoever they made them to anyway, and they help to come in to corroborate the victim's statement on the record. So those would come in anyway. If you have a victim, though, who is unavailable because of incompetency or memory problems, diminished capacity, that kind of thing, is still alive and there's no problem, I mean, the health is fairly good, but the memory isn't there, for instance, then there would have to be a hearing in front of the judge, and the judge would have to show that those statements the victim made were corroborated, first of all, and then he'd have to show that they're reliable. And there's various factors the court goes through to show reliability. And if the court finds that the statements are corroborated and reliable, then the victim's testimony, even though the victim wouldn't testify, the victim's statements would still be admissible, because in a sense what happens is the victim's unavailable because of memory problems and that sort of thing. Now, oftentimes you'll get a victim, though, that is lucid about some things, but there are other things he or she may not remember. So they make a poor witness. Under 803.18a.b, as amended by Senate Bill 780, those statements that she would or he would have made to third parties will still come and help support the case. So either way, whether the victim is unavailable or available, the statements still come into evidence, which is why it's so important in these kind of cases. I might point out to the court, you folks, though, that the way Senate Bill 780 is written right now, the most important part has been left out. And I think maybe it was just an error. But if you'll look at your Senate Bill 780, and if you look at page 3, it's line 6. It says, is subject to cross-examination or was chronologically or mentally under 12 years of age at the time. What was forgotten to put in, I think, must have been just an oversight, was that you have to add, or 65 years of age or older. And that was not put in there. It was put in under subsection D on page 4, but for some reason it didn't get into line 6. And it is what makes this statute applicable in elder abuse cases. If without that, it just guts the whole thing, so to speak. So I would urge you at some point in time, obviously I don't know if you're able to do that today, but maybe a work session or something, to go back and amend and add to Senate Bill 780 that language that allows it to be someone 65 years of age or older who are unavailable. Because right now it's only a child. If a child under 12 is unavailable, not the elder person. And that's a very, very, very important part of this whole Senate bill. It is the most important of this Senate bill, practically.
All right. Sir,
John Turner, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm from the Marion County District Attorney's Office and would, first of all, like to represent that in addition to us, those of us before you, that the Oregon District Attorney's Association does support this bill as well. And I would like to add my support for Mr. Knapp's urging you to make that amendment. I think that is critical, and it must have been an oversight. There was also discussion about another bill amending the definition of elder abuse, which I am not as involved with as these gentlemen. They might be able to respond better, but that would need to be changed, or that should be changed, in my opinion, to include financial abuse as well as physical abuse. And I will defer to these gentlemen when I'm through to urge you to adopt that. I wanted to indicate that this bill adds the elderly to the vulnerable victims that are already included in this statute, the children and developmentally disabled. And that has been the law for long enough, as indicated, for there to be challenges, for there to for have it to work in the real world. And the same safeguards that are there for defendants in cases where the victims are children or developmentally disabled people are there for the elder victims as well. The court makes a determination of the reliability of the statement. There is a mechanism in the law to allow the defendant to ensure his rights are upheld, and this statement is reliable and should be admitted.
I want to interrupt you for just a second, because
sure.
the language that you were talking about on line 6, page 3, the full paragraph, it says, a statement made by a person concerning an act of abuse as defined in ORS 107705 or 419B005, or concerning an act of abuse of an elderly person, as those terms are defined in 124050. When I turn to that statute, it defines an elderly person as any person 65 years of age or older. So it seems to me that it already says what you want it to say. It just doesn't say it as explicitly as you might want it to say.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if I may, the problem is you have to go further. If you read that, it says, is not excluded by ORS 40.455, which is your hearsay exception, if the declarant either testifies at the proceeding and is subject to cross-examination, and here it is, or was chronologically and mentally under 12 years of age at the time the statement was made and is unavailable as a witness.
I see what you're saying.
So what 803.18AAB does now by itself is it covers children under 12 who are unavailable as a witness. For instance, if you had a child who was 13 years old or 14 years old and they weren't available as a witness, the way 803.18AAB reads, that child's statements to other people that are hearsay are not coming in. And I think that was a legislative decision to protect the youngest, the most frail of children, under 12. So what we're asking to do is add to that language on the unavailability, 65 years of age or older, to also cover that vulnerable population.
Okay, I get it.
And that's what we're getting at there.
Right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, while we're discussing those particular lines, I would say first that I'm sure that the Elder Abuse Task Force would be fine with both the amendments that we've heard mentioned, the one you were just discussing and then the one that Mr. Turner mentioned. The latter, as the bill is currently written, the definition of elder abuse in ORS 124050 does not include financial abuse. In order to include financial abuse in the allegations that would trigger the applicability of this exception to the hearsay rule, the committee would need to add a reference to the criminal mistreatment statute. And we'd be happy to work with committee counsel to come up with a specific language, but the
it won't fit in this bill, by the way.
I'm sorry, Mr.
It won't fit in this bill.
Mr. Chair,
relating to evidence.
I think it would fit in this bill.
Well, you are the Deputy Attorney General.
I am, sir. I think it would fit in the bill because it pertains not to the offense of criminal mistreatment itself, but rather to the evidence that would be admissible in a given proceeding. And so what we're doing is establishing the conditions upon which evidence would be admissible. So we can define the scope of that to be consistently with the relating clause to be as broadly as narrow or as narrow as we'd like. But we, in order for this bill to cover hearsay statements in financial abuse of the elderly cases as well as physical abuse of the elderly, which is included in 124050, we would need to do a little bit of work with the language in order to make sure that was encompassed.
Okay. I cut you off, too, and I'm sorry. But
no problem, Mr. Chairman. Additionally, you had asked for examples, and I had a case where the victim was an elderly female in very poor physical health. Her mental health was deteriorating, but she was not suffering from severe dementia, but she was very physically frail. And it was a case both of financial and physical, neglect, financial abuse and neglect. Her grandson was the care provider. And the evidence I had, there was evidence of him abandoning her or leaving her for periods of time, but I needed to prove that it placed her at risk and that she was at risk of suffering harm. And in one instance, a neighbor had come by with Vicks vapor rub or whatever under her nose to deal with the smell, to provide food for this woman because she was not provided for by her caregiver, and found her on the floor by her bed. She had fallen out of her wheelchair and had told the neighbor that she had been there for 3 days. And that statement would not come in ordinarily. I would need the victim to come into court and tell that. And even if she were mentally fine to do that, and if she remembered and all of the other things, I would have placed her at risk, placed her health at risk by bringing her into court, dragging her into the, I wouldn't have dragged her into the courtroom, but bringing her into the courtroom, putting her on the stand, would not have been in her interest, and I would have been confronted with that dilemma of what to do. This bill would allow that statement to the neighbor to come in. The judge could make a determination of the circumstances, was it reliable, was there corroboration, various things could be gone through, but that potentially could come into evidence under this bill. There was another with an elderly female, again, that did have dementia and was slapped a number of times by her son, who was providing care for her. And the neighbor came in after this had happened and was talking with her and asked her, Mabel, where are your glasses? And she looked around and, oh, they must have fallen off when my son slapped me. And it was just a natural statement. And if I could have shown that she was still under the excitement and duress of the event, it may have come in under the excited utterance exception. But if not, it wouldn't have come in. And I wouldn't have had her to come testify that it was her son who caused the injuries that the doctor could testify to. But with this bill, I could potentially get that statement in of identifying who caused these injuries to her. So those are a couple of examples that would enable us not only to convict the wrongdoers and get them away from the particular victims in society as a whole, hopefully, but also to protect the victims and not re-victimize them by making them either place their physical health at risk by having to come into court or their emotional health, because a lot of this is extremely embarrassing to elder people, and it doesn't have to be sexual abuse, although there is that of elderly people that is extremely embarrassing, but I find the victims that I deal with of financial abuse where relatives or care providers have drained their bank accounts, they're extremely embarrassed that they feel stupid, like it's their fault, and they don't want to have to deal with that. It's really hard on them. So this could help alleviate some of that as well. Thank you.
All right. Questions? Thank you very much. Any questions? No? All right. Thank you. I think we've got Phyllis Rand.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Whoops. I was just going to get it closer.
You break it, you
okay.
Bite.
Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Phyllis Rand. I'm the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, and I'm the legislative coordinator for the commission. And I'm here today to give strong support for Senate Bill 780.
Well, you signed up in opposition.
Oh.
So you have to testify now.
Sorry. I have signed up in opposition so many times that I'm afraid it must have been a reflex rather than a thoughtful X. So anyway, we're in strong support of Senate Bill 780. Elder abuse, physical, sexual, psychological, financial, or neglect, is a serious concern for victims and their loved ones. It is also a most serious problem for society. And although the estimates vary, there are somewhere between 4% and 6% of the elderly are abused. Now that's a national study. And according to the National Incident Study on Elder Abuse, apparently approximately 450,000 elderly experienced abuse in 1996, and we don't have the figures for later than that, but you can imagine as the elderly population booms, the figures are going to increase markedly. personal losses associated with abuse can be devastating, and they include loss of independence, homes, life savings, health, dignity, security. And within the combined experience of the members of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, the most devastating result they feel is the crushing blow of the elder spirit. So victims of elder abuse have been shown to have a shorter life expectancy than a non-abused older person. And elder abuse leads to premature dependency and dependency on the publicly funded long-term care system. And with that, I would like to urge you to pass Senate Bill 780. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Questions, Senator Burdick.
Chairman, in these national studies that you mentioned, who are the abusers of these? Or children, who are the abusers usually?
I'm sorry, I haven't seen the study, but I will get that information to you.
Here comes the study.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, the majority of perpetrators that we see in most forms of elder abuse are family members, whether they're the son or the daughter, or the grandson or the granddaughter. Unfortunately, it's a very familiar crime, or in situations of neglect. And that's because a lot of the caregiving is taking place in the home, more so than in the facility.
All right. You certified smart people come back up here for just a second, will you? Just run down this list of proposed amendments to this thing that we want to make sure that we've got it on our... Chair Pete Shepard, I just wanted to make sure you included me in that list.
Certified smart of me, absolutely.
Mr. Chair, I think we have two amendments that we need to deal with. One is the amendment on page 3 to add the reference to older than 65. And the second is probably also on the same page, needs to incorporate in some way reference not only to the definition of elder abuse as defined in Chapter 124, but also instances of elder abuse, allegations of violations of the criminal mistreatment statutes taking place in an elder abuse context. And obviously that language is not exactly precise, but... the concept would be we need to include the definition of elder abuse. We need to include criminal mistreatment involving elder abuse in the offenses that will trigger the application of the exception. I think I've got that right.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I might add also that it would be important to add criminal mistreatment because the criminal mistreatment statute includes theft and various things like that from someone who is responsible or taking care of an elder person.
You're suggesting we need references to those existing statutes, correct?
The statute that the criminal mistreatment statute is in Chapter ORS 163.
Okay.
And the definition of elder abuse, as it's referred to in the statute, of course, it's right there. It says ORS 124.0506.
Mm-hmm.
What I wanted to emphasize was the criminal mistreatment, by adding in the criminal mistreatment statute, either in Senate Bill 780 or modifying ORS 124.050 to include criminal mistreatment, you will also, I would think, want to consider adding some way to add the elements of financial exploitation.
But that's where I'm unclear. Where would you want to put that?
Well, I would have to defer to Mr. Shepard, but I would think that you would want to possibly expand the definition under 124.050 to include some way of defining financial exploitation, either elements of that
or actually referring to specific ORS statutes like the ones for theft, forgery, that type of thing, or combine them.
Okay.
But the problem is you do have financial exploitation that occurs outside of the criminal mistreatment statute that you've got to bring it in somehow.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think my suggestion to the committee, and again, if the chair's desire is to set this for a work session later, we'd be happy to work with the committee staff to refine that. We do have this bill, the relating clause on this bill is relating to evidence, and so I do not think we could use this bill to amend substantively 124.04.050 or any other statute. I do think we could add a reference in this bill to additional statutes, however we want to make that, however broad we want to make that list. And we would want to make explicit cross-reference to those statutes. My suggestion would be the criminal mistreatment statute would probably pick up most of the financial abuse cases, but again, we'd be happy to work with committee counsel to get the exact language fine-tuned.
Okay. I think what we're probably going to have to do, if we're going to probably do a little bit of work on this and see if we need substantive changes to the 124.050 and 163, whatever it is. If we do, then we've probably got some other vehicles in here that are related to crime or related to whatever that we might be able to put that in.
Mr. Chair, I might say, just for your planning purposes, the Elder Abuse Task Force did recommend some substantive changes to 124.050. They, because of the timing of the introduction of bills, they were introduced as a House bill. And my recommendation to this committee would, and to my colleagues, would be not to adhere this the concept of this bill to the substantive changes in 124.050, as those may be more controversial than this bill is likely to be.
All right. So at least what I'm hearing you say is you'd like to see us create some clear guidance with respect to financial abuse or whatever you're calling it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's exactly correct. And I think what Mr. Shepard's saying is that on page 3, line 5, where it says, or concerning active abuse of an elderly person as those terms are defined in ORS 124.050, can go on and just add statutory numbers if it wanted to. It could add the statute number for criminal mistreatment, the first degree, second degree. It could add theft, forgery, fraud, whatever the committee feels are those main financial exploitation crimes that occur outside the criminal mistreatment statute.
Right.
And the major ones are the theft, the forgery, the burglary, maybe that type of thing. That's what we typically see.
All right. Whatever works, we'll make it happen, I think.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Any questions, comments, concerns about any other business before the committee?